Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast, the source. I'm Terry Foy. He's Matt Kinnear. Matt, we've both been on podcasts in the not too distant past, but it's been a while since we've been on together. How are you doing, buddy?
Doing great. We tend to do the off season as our podcasting together, which is pretty awesome. And we've both been on the road. You've been on the road a lot more than I have. We're both sunburnt and in the midst of summer lacrosse, so we'll be full of energy. Let's do it.
No doubt. This is a nice reprieve where we're basically talking about everything that's unfolded over the last month to 6 weeks. There have been, you know, we've I think thoroughly autopsied the 2024 season. Nick Osello and I did two postseason podcasts. If you missed those, check those out. And then Dan Kaplan has led the way on the Isle Preps podcast. 2 weeks ago, he had a couple of state championship coaches on, state championship winning coaches on to talk about their journeys. And then this past week, Dan Abram joined he and I, and we talked about septet of events that we had been to at that point. We're going to be coming back later this week to talk about everything that had unfolded over the course of the intervening week, what we had seen. And then if you missed it on Monday, make sure to check out Kevin Brown and Chris Rosenthal's PLL podcast. You and I are recording this on Sunday morning, June 23rd. It's going to post on Wednesday. And there might be some developments that occur over the course of the next 72 hours. And if so, we apologize. But generally speaking, we're going to start by talking about all the coaching news, and then we're going to transition into talking about the transfer news. And it's probably more likely that some of those developments will be our kind of highest rated players still available, having made their college choice. We're going to do two drafts. We're going to draft the most impactful transfers whose destinations we already know. So basically, you know, of the nearly 100 incoming Division I transfers, who's going to have the greatest impact? You're going to pick 10. I'm going to pick 10. And then we're going to pick basically the best players that are still available, whose destinations we don't know. And you're going to pick three. I'm going to pick three. A lot of those transfer destinations have already been determined. Excited to get into it. And I think that the best place to start is with Brown tapping High Point head coach John Torpy. It's the lone Division I head coach to Division I head coach move of the five, you know, Division I head coach openings that have been filled so far this offseason. And certainly Brown, having made it to the Final Four in 2016, the highest profile program that made a move. What was your reaction to the news?
I mean, it's a knockout hire. I think for years we've been saying, and you know Coach Torpy probably better than I do, you've gone to campus a few times and you've gone to practices and stuff like that. But he has been, you know, that guy who, you know, when you're talking about, oh, when this next big job opens up, John Torpy is always in the conversation. I think he is perfect in the way that, you know, he's got the familiarity with the Ivy League, but he's also got this, like, upstart energy that he brought to High Point, you know, in a different kind of environment and, you know, different resources and all of those things. So it's pretty much as good of a hire as you can make for Brown. So that was an awesome job by them, and he's going to do great there. You know, Brown obviously had a rough season, and they have higher expectations than that. And John Torpy seems like the perfect guy if you want to get that turned back around.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to this. I think when it's hard to divorce a combination of the search and the quality of the job, and even really the decision to move on from Mike Daly, from kind of the status of the athletic department within the university. And you know, this is an athletic department that within the last 5 years made overtures toward dropping 9 sports. They ultimately did not do that. They've had a athletic director transition from Jack Hayes, who was a well-known, you know, significant advocate of men's lacrosse, to Grace Calhoun, who hired a women's coach last year and now a men's coach this year. So it's a place that lacrosse really matters. When you look at the history of the program, there's kind of a binary between the coaches that had success, and depending on how you define success, NCAA tournament trips and NCAA semifinal appearances, versus the ones that didn't. And, you know, we're pretty familiar with one of those guys in Peter Lasagna, who wrote the back page column for Inside Lacrosse for 20 plus years. And, you know, his comment to me when the search was ongoing was, you know, referring to himself, Lars Tiffany and Dom Starja, the guys who had had the most success were the alums. And I don't think that he was trying to make the argument that it's a place where you need to be an alum to be successful. He was trying to make the argument that it is unique in the landscape of both New England lacrosse, the Ivy League, and wherever, you know, whatever the parameters you want to put onto it, such that in order to find success, you need to be familiar with it. And there was, you know, one alum who at least was in the consideration matrix, that being John Thompson, who's an offensive coordinator at North Carolina after a stop in Air Force on the heels of you know, the end of his tenure at Amherst, where he built them into an NCAA runner-up in, I believe it was 2019. It might have been 2018, mm-hmm. though. 2019 it was, because it was in Philly. And you know, beyond that, the candidate pool included guys like Chris Wojcik and Jim Mitchell and Jesse Bernhardt. And I think when you – and this is – my comments about Torp are not going to be disparaging in any respect to the approach that I think those guys would have taken to the job. But taking what Pete said to me and transposing it into my interpretation of how you need to be successful at Brown relative to competing against the group that you – are going to be measured by, which is, you know, certainly Princeton, Yale, Cornell, right? Which, you know, and mixing Penn in there, the cream of the Ivy League over the course of the last decade, roughly, as well as Harvard and Dartmouth, both of whom, you know, have had coaching changes, Dartmouth last year, Harvard in 2019, but still because of COVID, it kind of feels like, you know, it's a relatively new regime that's kind of getting its feet wet. The primary attribute that I think is necessary to be successful at Brown is you have to develop an approach specifically in recruiting where the term I would use is you're outflanking your competition. The way I would describe what you can't do, or what I don't think is the most prudent way to build a roster that's going to be able to get your share of Ivy League wins, is the phrase that I use is standing in the middle of the ring and exchanging haymakers. And you know what I mean by that is you can't expect to build a roster of, you know, guys from Malvern and Lawrenceville and Chaminade and St. Anthony's and, you know, the places that a lot of your competition are going to go for their best players and expect to win more than 25 and maybe even less percentage of the recruiting battles, which is what's going to be required in order to beat Harvard and Penn and Princeton. And so whatever approach you adopt, and I think that Yale and I can define Yale's recruiting approach a little bit more specifically than I can Cornell's, but I do think that those two, you know, have developed a recruiting approach that's a little different from what Harvard, Penn, and Princeton have done, you know, where those groups, I think, you know, and this is going to, again, sound a little bit disparaging, but like, you know, they're looking for the best players. I don't think that Cornell and Yale are looking for the best players. I think they're looking for the players that kind of, and you know, it's not about they fit the program the best, it's that they fit the thing that they're looking for the best. And so my point is, I think that's what Brown needs to adopt. And I think that relative to the other guys that were in the mix, John Torpy has a better track record of doing that at High Point than the other guys do, in my estimation and in my opinion. And, you know, really the best way of putting it is that if you look at his roster and where those kids are from, what high schools they went to, and what club teams they played for, you know, they're non-traditional, right? And obviously Asher Nolting is the, you know, the pinnacle example of a player who was originally committed to Air Force. So it's not as if nobody wanted him, right? And then, you know, by the time he kind of popped on the radar and was like a borderline top 50 recruit, I remember, you know, he garnered serious consideration for the Under Armour All-America game, which would have put him in that group of, you know, top 12, top 14 attackmen in the class. Ultimately, he wasn't selected, but he was well known enough on that profile that like you could have seen a Maryland or a you know, whatever, Hopkins coming in late and trying to get that commitment from him. Torp was able to maintain that commitment, and then he stayed, you know, all throughout his career at High Point. But that's not the only example. I mean, look at Braden Maia and Jack Van Overbeek, who just finished tremendous careers at High Point and now are legitimate, you know, PLL contenders. Like, those are the types of players that you can expect Torp to find and bring to Brown. The question is, you know, if you take High Point's roster and put it in the Ivy League, like, how good is it? And the answer is, it's probably not good enough to meet the standard for what the expectations of this hire are, which means that, you know, he's got to find a degree up from that. Mm-hmm. And for me, the prevalent question is, like, does that player exist? Right. So whether it's going to Texas or Ohio or Michigan or wherever else, you know, and finding the best player, not in Columbus, but in Toledo. Right. Like, is that player going to be good enough such that, you know, when he's a junior and senior at Brown, you know, that's a roster that can, you know, win the Ivy League once every 4 years and, you know, make a Final Four run once every 7 years. Because I think that's kind of the standard that he's going to be judged by, in addition to all the other factors, such as, you know, how he gets along with the rest of the department, how he kind of, you know, does the things that his bosses want him to do. So, you know, that'll be the part that I'm going to follow closely. And I'm really excited to watch him take the challenge.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, I mean, look at their roster right now, and you know, I think someone like Tommy Meehan, like, he's like a Baltimore area kid, but he's not a Baltimore, you know, he's from Havre de Grace. You know, it's like, you get the guys who are from North Carolina, obviously that's High Point and that's a different story. But I mean, look at Lars Tiffany and what he did at Brown, and he did it by being a little bit weird, right? Like, it's kind of like, you use the term outflank your competition. It's like, you gotta be a little bit weird. You gotta be a little bit like, find what is going to work for you. Because yeah, you're not going to just one-on-one out-recruit Harvard. You're not going to one-on-one out-recruit Cornell or Penn or Princeton.
I mean, you could, and you will, you could, for a certain percentage of the guys, but not for enough overtime that you can build an entire roster.
Yeah.
Because again, like, it's funny, you know, I use St. Anthony's as an example. Meanwhile, Dylan Malloy and I believe Jack Kelly are like two of the cornerstones of that Final Four team, and they're St. Anthony's guys. So, you know, but the point was that Dylan Malloy, like, people couldn't picture who he was going to be in college, and it wasn't Jack Kelly the backup, right? Like, isn't that the whole, like, kind of famous part of his recruitment story? So, but to your point about, like, you know, there's also, I remember the early Brown teams that made the NCAA tournament. The early in Lars's tenure, excuse me. So not 2016, but the you know, I think 2013 maybe made it and had a first round game against Hopkins. I loved that team. That was so much fun. But at the same time, like, you know, the gap between that and what they were in 2016 is substantial, A, and B, a reflection of the point that you just made, which is, you know, they brought in Sean Kerwin and adopted this Tufts philosophy of flying up and down the field. Now, granted, would they have had success that they had they not been saving the ball at 70% and winning faceoffs at 70%? Unknowable question. Likely not. But the point is that,
but they had it, so they did it.
Exactly, so, I mean, right?
Yeah.
What's the value in trying to answer that kind of non-factual, counterfactual. So, but the point is that it was a combination of both those things, right? Like Lars' familiarity with the institution and his ability to find good players who were going to be fits with Brown wasn't enough to make them a Final Four team. It was this combination of, you know, a wunderkind offensive coordinator and a non-conventional style that is what got them over the hump. And so who knows what the progress chart or like the linear path of progress is going to be for Torp. But that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that it's not just about building a roster and a culture. It's also about adopting a style of play that's going to be successful on the field, especially given your competition.
For sure. And, you know, we have to now talk about where he left High Point, which is a place where think we all had it figured out that you know, it was going to be kind of replaced in-house, but that wasn't the case. And instead, John Crawley is going to be taken over as the High Point coach. And obviously, he's one of those guys who everyone has known. He's a brilliant offensive mind. And, you know, you see how after he took over for a junior at Johns Hopkins, and the growth rate that Johns Hopkins had underneath him was pretty remarkable. Lehigh, he had a pretty great track record there as well. You know, so he seems like that young assistant who's ready for the next challenge to take over a program. Obviously, that has a learning curve in itself, being the head coach. And the thing that I was thinking of with this, because that's the million-dollar question, right, is how does a guy who is still early-ish in his career, has been an assistant coach, how do you take that step into being a head coach? Because it's a different skill set, and it's a different you know, you can't just be relying on the X's and O's. You have to be managing a program and the personnel that's associated with it. And I was thinking of, you know, does Will Scudder's success at Lehigh give some, you know, air of confidence that, you know, the preparation that he had in his time with Kevin Cassis a few years ago, and then the way that Pete Milliman empowers his assistants. You know, I think it's pretty fair to say that he's a guy who lets his assistants, lets his assistants grow and take on work without being micromanaged. I think that lays a pretty strong groundwork for what he can do as a head coach at High Point.
Yeah. No, I think it's well said. There are a couple things that I would add to it. The first being, he has an air about him that feels like an executive, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And I think that that's an important distinction between a really well-qualified lacrosse brain then that has to make the transition into being a head coach. And so I think that I can imagine him interviewing very well because of the way in which he presents as that. But I also think that there's another side of the coin, which is that if you're the athletic director at High Point and, you know, you've got this set of candidates, and, you know, one of the core criteria for me is, how convinced am I that this guy wants this job as opposed to just wants to be a head coach? Because I think that's the distinction between how creative they're going to be in understanding the unique challenges that this place provides and then attacking them. And I think that, you know, both, it's easy to reverse engineer by virtue of the fact that he got the job, but I also think that it's true in terms of the conversations both that I had with him throughout and then kind of the secondhand, that it was clear that this was an appealing job on its merits for a particular reason. And, you know, so just to kind of dive a little further into a combination of like how Torpy led the program as well as how the university's unique identity is manifesting in what it means for the quality of this job straight up and down. So, you know, I've said and written this before, it's a country club as a college campus. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. The thing that changed between when I visited a few years ago and then when I visited most recently, like 2 years ago, is they built this immaculate basketball arena. It is one of the most impressive things that I've seen. They've gone through, you know, conference change as an affiliate in the A-10, moving from what would have been the A-Sun. It was, you know, that move kind of brought about the downfall of the SoCon because, you know, they aspire to a higher level of conference affiliation, and that's not limited to men's lacrosse. And I think right now the point of view as a university is, you know, basketball is our path. But I don't think that that means that there is this long-term drag on the men's lacrosse team, especially because, you know, for most of the last 12, 13 years, there has been so many tailwinds behind the program. And Torp has done such a good job of cultivating those, be they financially or community-based, that I think John steps into a position where, you know, as long as he can kind of harness those tailwinds, keep them like blowing in the right direction, you know, even though there might be a primary focus on basketball for the short term, you know, there is an opportunity where there's going to be a reversion back to, you know, the amount of emphasis that might have been placed on men's lacrosse in, you know, kind of the preceding term. And I think that, you know, relative to that, the challenge is how good the conference is. And it's only going to get better by virtue of Delaware coming in as an affiliate as well, right? And mm-hmm. and so when you look at what Richmond offers, you know, and they've kind of been a little bit of the bully in the league and obviously a rival of High Point relative to UMass or St. Joe's because both of proximity and the fact that they started within a year of each other as a program and the fact that they had been in the conference together previous to being in the A-10, right? Like, you know, it's a hard standard to measure up to in a lot of ways. And High Point has made a lot of progress in order to do that. But that, you know, is going to be one of the metrics that's going to be a challenge, right? As far as the practical aspects of the job, you know, I think first and foremost, and, you know, I ran into John at Crab Feast the day before. It'll, you know, have been 4 days by the time this game comes out. And I got a little bit of an update from him. So, you know, some of this is, you know, our conversation was kind of like blurred between on and off the record. So I won't share a ton of detail. But, you know, I think first and foremost, hiring Alex Reddy, which Kevin Brown reported last week, was enormous because, you know, the duplicative effect of just having a second person, right? Both in terms of, all right, now we can divide up who we're talking to. And then secondly, like I have somebody that knows lacrosse that I can bounce ideas off of, right? Not just somebody within the department or whatever else. So that was obviously huge. You know, he did say he's not in a rush with his second and third assistants because of the value of getting Alex in so quickly. And so, you know, I don't think that, you know, like I said, we're recording on Sunday. I don't think that by Wednesday when you're listening to this, he will have made a decision on his second or third assistant. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll see. The other element is getting to know the guys on the current roster, and particularly the guys that are in the transfer portal that, you know, on the basis of how good they are, their production last year, want to be a part of the team. And he did say that they got three of those guys back, right? They've withdrawn from the portal and are going to be Panthers next season. Tommy Meehan was one of them, and that was a big win, not just for, you know, the quality of the roster next year, but also the comfort of the rest of the roster, meaning that, you know, if you've got some of these leaders or players who probably had opportunities to go elsewhere, and they said, I want to be a part of this, well, that's a huge endorsement, right? So that goes a long way. And then,
and I think that gives you capital within your athletic department too. Like,
for sure.
Oh, my first week on the job, I got three guys to stay that were going to go elsewhere.
For sure.
Who knows what that means long term, but that's big.
Yeah. And then now, you know, the 24s have signed their NLIs. They're going to be on campus, and you'll evaluate them when they arrive. But there still is opportunity with the 25s, right? And, you know, because the prior High Point staff recruited such a you know, big recruiting classes, there's a lot of work to be done with the guys that they had taken verbal commitments from in that 25 class in terms of just seeing them, getting to know who they are, getting familiar with them, and then figuring out whether or not they're going to be the right fits for the program going forward. So, you know, those are the immediate tasks on the to-do list, and we'll see. We'll see how it continues to develop, but excited to see what John does. And there's one thing I want to add, because, you know, when I think I brought this up when Pete hired him 2 years ago, and it remains top of mind, and I think it's an important anecdote. There is nothing that, you know, I have seen or come across that underscores how good of a coach I think John Crowley is and is going to continue to develop into being as the clip in the PLL documentary Fate of a Sport, when Crowley, a teammate of Paul Rabel's, basically called him out in in a post game team session during the, I believe, 2020 championship series bubble in Utah, and basically said, like, I don't trust that you are going to make the right decision with the ball. And I thought that was so bold and so impressive. And then obviously, like, you know, it impressed Rabel, who I believe had Final Cut on the dock, to the point where he felt good about including it, right? Like, both the actual, like, the text, right? And then the subtext of the fact that it made it in, you know, both those elements really underscored, like, you know, this is a guy with both the credibility and the authority to do the job. And, you know, that will remain in my memory for the entirety of his coaching tenure.
Big basketball guy, too. You know, his offense built on basketball principles. And I forget who I was talking to at Lehigh. It was a player who basically, like, just played basketball with him, you know, after practice and stuff like that. And that was, like, a big part of his development, was just playing basketball with John Crowley, and, like, how that, like, translated onto the field using those principles, and, you know, kind of just while you're shooting, like, all the, you know, talking about spacing and things like that. Just great mind, and going to be difficult for Johns Hopkins to replace. And I think that, you know, when this happened, I think our initial conversation was, I think Pete's going to do something outside the box, and just, like, in his nature, like, oh, is it going to be, you know, when John Grant Jr. was first announced, like, that was a, for lack of a better term, that was an odd hire. Like, that was, like, not who anyone expected. It was a left turn. I think he's a guy who's known for doing these kind of left turns. I don't know if you would call it outside the box, but Brian Kelly taking over as offensive coordinator, I don't think was what people expected. And then Chase Erland joining the staff as the Dolo as well. What do you make of the new Johns Hopkins lacrosse staff?
I think a couple things. The first is it speaks to Pete's loyalty, and that being a really important part of what he valued in this process. It speaks to how he prioritized familiarity and continuity, right? It's not just promoting a guy who had been on your staff for 2 or 3 years in Brian Kelly, as well as John Cohen, who'd been the Dolo since he arrived in 2020, but also a player who, A, you recruited to come to Cornell, and then B, you re-recruited to come to Hopkins, and then C, you know, he was the goalie on your team this year. So I think that's the other element. And then the third is, you know, I saw a lot of this chatter online, and I think it's right. I think it's an expression of the fact that, you know, Pete wants to be more hands-on with the offense. And I think that, you know, that is, to me, a reflection more than anything else of the fact that he feels comfortable by virtue of you know, the 4 years of experience that he has as the Johns Hopkins head coach, as well as the contract extension that he just received, that he's got he knows that he has enough bandwidth that he can do the administrative duties of being the head coach while also having a heavier hand in the offense working with Brian Kelly on it. So those are my interpretations. And, you know, as far as what the results yield, I don't know. It's going to be really hard to evaluate this season in a number of ways, right? Because it's not just about it's not just about the staff changes and everything else that's like unfolded. It's that, you know, there was always going to be more upheaval and turnover by virtue of the personnel, Division I wide, and specifically in the ACC and Big Ten. And obviously Johns Hopkins is not immune from that. So, you know, there were a lot of things that were going to be on, you know, kind of discovered, right, that were going to be unrelated to, you know, some of the kind of, like, for in this instance, Johns Hopkins offensive coordinator change, right? When you don't have Jacob Angeles and Garrett Degnan and all the other pieces that you lost, like, your offense is going to be different regardless of who's running it. So it'll be hard to evaluate because there are too many independent variables, but it'll be interesting because, you know, we're going to infer a lot, and we're going to have to ask directly to the staff, you know, how's this manifesting? What's it look like?
We can take 2 hours and discuss, is Johns Hopkins back?
we've already done it, so no, we can't. That horse is dead. That bone has been chewed down.
That media narrative.
There's no more sinew. There's no more. Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about Merrimack, a program that you're pretty familiar with. You know, an unfortunate end to Mike Morgan's tenure in the wake of a situation in their regular season contest versus Albany, and they brought in St. Anselm head coach Mike Schiamana to lead the program. Logical in some senses, given that Merrimack was a Division II program that Morgan led the transition into being Division I, right? So, you know, they're going back to the D2 well, but it's also local, right? And familiar with kind of the nuances, challenges, you know, the nature of New England lacrosse and everything else that goes along with it. And then one thing I heard after the decision was made that I thought was interesting was they scrimmaged in the preseason. And the folks that I talked to around Merrimack were really impressed by what St. Anselm put on the field. So yeah, you're our D2 guy. What did you think of this decision?
You know, I think if you look at where St. A's was back in, you know, 2013, 2014, coach was hired in 2015, and where they've been since then, I mean, that's pretty just like, you know, a logical, like, they got immensely better very quickly after he was hired, and, you know, were NCAA semifinalists this year. You know, they became a consistent top 10 team under his tenure. And, you know, it feels like kind of the profile, and like you said, Merrimack is still a new D1 program. It feels like a similar type of guy and a similar type of blueprint that he could use to lead this Merrimack program. It will be very difficult, though. You know, I think this is kind of obviously it was an odd and dramatic situation that Coach Morgan, you know, departed from the program. He's a guy who basically built that program from the ground up in terms of its, you know, the seriousness of which it took at the D2 level and becoming, you know, not just a great D2 team, but the D2 team for a few years there, transitioning to D1, you know, he's had his fingerprints on that forever. So that's tough in its own right. The way that he departed and the loyalty that his players had to him is something that is going to be a huge roadblock to overcome. He can do it because obviously the proof is there that he's a good coach and can win ball games. But you know, if you look at the portal, Merrimack's got a lot of guys in there. They've got, you know, somewhere around the top six scorers have found new places to go. Their top defenseman, top D-middy, top faceoff guy, a bunch of other guys are weighing their options. So in the similar way that Crawley had to kind of, you know, prove it to the guys who were in that gray area, that's got to be priority number one, along with finding a staff, which, you know, is something that maybe by the time that this is published, he'll have his staff in place. Maybe it'll be quickly after that. So it's going to be some tough sledding, but, you know, he seems like the guy who fits the profile and can have success there.
Yeah, it's an interesting job in a variety of ways. It was an interesting search process in a variety of ways as well. There were a couple of candidates that, you know, it felt like if they wanted to be in Division I coaching, like, this was going to be their opportunity, and ultimately it didn't come to pass. So yeah, wish him nothing but the best, and excited to see how he continues to fill out his staff.
Jake Richard taking over at Marquette was another interesting hire. you know, I think we both have a little bit of insight into that process, but, you know, he was the guy that I had heard very early that, hey, they like Jake Richard, you know, he's going to be the guy. And then I kind of heard later, you know, they were doing the search and kind of had some ideas and different directions that they might want to go. And then they ultimately came back to him. You know, he feels like a guy who, when you think of Marquette Lacrosse, kind of is like symbolic of who they are in terms of an under the radar guy who, you know, took a chance to go out there, got a lot better, you know, lunch pail kind of guy who is now a pro lacrosse player and, you know, is now leading the program. So in that regard, he feels like, you know, if you had to say like who represents Marquette Lacrosse better than anyone, he would be a guy that's definitely at the top of that list.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think that we're talking out of class or school or whatever the expression is by saying that, you know, we did talk to the administration throughout the process. You know, they were asking our opinion and, you know, they were sharing their thoughts and desires for where they wanted to see the program go. And, you know, one thing that became very clear very early was they wanted another Joe Amplo. And now, did they want him from the standpoint of his traits? Did they want him from the standpoint of the outcomes? Did they want him from the standpoint of his approach? Like, you know, I didn't get that level of detail. But it's pretty, I will say, like, you know, there are actually a handful of Joe Amplos walking around, right? Like, you can get John Orson and, you know, you can make the argument that you're getting John Amplo or Joe Amplo. you can get Kevin Unterstein, and, you know, there's a lot of shared DNA, right, between Hofstra, Tuff, and everything else like that. But you've got one in the office, right? And, you know, a guy who's been as loyal to the program as anybody. And so, you know, on the merits of having earned it, there's no question. And now I think that I've had this conversation with a number of his colleagues, his being Jake's, and you know, they raised the point of, you know, it's interesting that you move on from a head coach and promote the assistant. And what does that say relative to, you know, basically the control the head coach had in setting the direction of the program relative to, you know, the assistants and everything else? And all I would say to that is, I don't know, right? Like, that's a level of internal familiarity that, you know, as reporters and outsiders, we're not going to be able to get with, you know, the level of certainty that I would want in order to be able to speak publicly about it. But at the same time, you know, it's not the first time it's ever happened. And you know, there are instances and examples where it's been successful and certainly, you know, others that have gone the other way. But, you know, one that immediately jumps to mind, we've already spent a fair amount of time talking about him on this podcast, is, you know, when Cornell moved on from Matt Kerwick and promoted Pete Milliman, you know, and that was, you know, he had tremendous success in immediately kind of changing the direction of the program. So like I said, there are enough examples either direction that I would say, you know, past precedent is not going to be the indicator of future success. But, you know, wish Jake nothing but the best. And it's an easy segue into talking about Charlie Hayes, who was promoted to take over at Detroit Mercy, because, you know, a D-Mitty who has been as loyal to the program and who's, you know, as intertwined with the identity of the program as anybody. And, you know, the only thing that was bizarre about that is I was under the impression after talking to both, you know, the outgoing head coach and some other folks within the administration that this was going to happen like 2 or 3 days after the end of the regular season. So the fact that it took a month, I mean, whatever, you know, I think that probably meant that it formally took a month. I don't think it meant that it practically took a month. I bet everybody that was involved and needed to know knew that this was the direction that it was going to go, you know. But another one where Detroit Mercy, kind of similar to Merrimack, is in flux from a program standpoint insofar as, you know, they more dramatically are actually changing conferences and going from the ASUN to the NEC. But a lot of opportunity, both in terms of program development, building out the schedule, as well as competing for a conference championship and get back into the NCAA tournament, given that, you know, the amount of traffic between you and that AQ just got cut in half. So, nothing but the best for Charlie and the Titans.
And you said a few times, we've said the word loyalty, you know, in regard to some of these coaching hires. And like, when you look at Charlie and you look at Jake, you know, Charlie's a Michigan native. Jake, like, basically his wife's a former, you know, Marquette student athlete. He had his kids over there. You know, if there's like, I think a big part of these programs that, you know, maybe have work to do in, you know, finding their identity, there is something to be said about longevity and consistency, and these guys potentially bring more than that, and it's not a stepping stone for them as much as like, hey, this is a place that I really feel strongly about and I want to be and build something. That's a tremendous asset to not be, you know, looking over your shoulder for the next big thing. So obviously things change. We don't know where, you know, any of these guys will be in 3 to 4 years or 5 years or whatnot, but there's certainly the potential to be, you know, these are long-term projects for these guys, not just short-term stepping stones.
And then the last one to keep an eye on is Duke's third assistant. You know, the job that Alex already vacated. No news on that so far. There's a lot of implications as far as that. You know, given the composition of the staff and how significant the program is gonna, how significantly different the program is gonna feel next year versus this year by virtue of all the talent that graduated. So just, you know, kind of, I don't want to call it an under the radar one, but just one to keep an eye on that. You know, might otherwise not have felt as significant. Without kind of considering all the extenuating circumstances.
And I mean, obviously the million-dollar question there is John Donowski, you know, he's getting older. You know, it seemed, I think there was a lot of buzz, a lot of social media buzz, and a lot of, I'd say more insidery buzz that, you know, maybe this was going to be John Donowski's last year. It seems like it would be a natural point with Brendan O'Neill and that spectacular class, you know, kind of graduating. But you know, the third assistant, like you said, and kind of the future of Duke lacrosse. You know, I'm not saying that I have any special knowledge or anything, but obviously when a guy has coached for that long and has accomplished many things, it's going to be his time at some point to step down and sail into the sunset and enjoy his retirement. So wondering when that looms for the Duke program.
No question. You know, I think that is true at Duke. I think it's true at Notre Dame. And I am never... I'm never going to want to retire somebody, and I'm using that as an active verb. Like, you know, for me, and I've said this about Kevin Corrigan. I said it to Kevin Corrigan with, I can't remember whether it was in the bowels of Lincoln Financial or in the weeks since, but you know, my take is kind of the notion is like, oh, you accomplished, you know, what you were trying to accomplish, right? You won a national championship. Now's the time to ride into the sunset. And I was like, if anything, the winning has extended this guy's career by 10 years because all of that pressure, all that weight that it felt like, you know, was sitting on his shoulders for the last 15 years when they've been knocking on the doorstep has been lifted. And it's made the job way more enjoyable. And by virtue of the job being way more enjoyable, I think that there's less desire to walk away when it just got really, really awesome. So, you know,
this is his time to enjoy it. And he's got an awesome staff that seems to be working together like so well. Yeah. I mean, he might be winning the 2030 national championship.
All right. Well, that actually is a pretty natural segue into talking about transfers, because obviously part of that success, both from the staff and from Notre Dame's winning the last two national championships, has been the impact of the guys that they have brought in. You know, certainly a lot of impact in 2022 between Brian Tevlin and Jack Simmons, and then Chris Fake down low and Chris Conlin, and then fast forwarding to 23, maybe not quite that level of impact, but Conlin was back, and certainly they got a tremendous season out of Devin McLean as well. So, you know, this year's transfer portal, I would say it's been equivalently active. I don't know that the amount of impact of the players is quite as active. We've had, you know, a few of those Ivy League guys that potentially could have made huge impacts, you know, decide that they weren't going to play any longer. Nick Ramsey, the Yale faceoff guy, being one that stands out for me. But that being said, there are also a ton of guys who are going to play. And so, Matt, I think the best way to structure this is we're each going to pick 10 guys on the basis of who we think is going to be the most impactful. I am going to concede off the top that you're going to do a better job with the D2 and D3 guys than I am, because you are more familiar with Division 2 and Division 3 than I am. And so that might be enough for you to win this draft. We're going to have to revisit this about 335 days from now. But with that being said, do you want to go first? Do you want to go second and third? We're going to do a snake draft style, or should we flip a coin?
I think I should go first, because I don't know if I had a hot take on Slack, but I had a very clear, like, this is going to be the number one guy that comes out of this transfer class. And I don't know
all
if
right,
you disagreed with it, but you didn't quite share my enthusiasm about it. So I think Johnny Hackett going to Virginia is an enormous pickup for Lars Tiffany, for Kevin Cassis in that Virginia offense. Part of it is just I love him as a player, his quickness and his athleticism. You know, I think he's about 6'1", 6'2". Played some attack his freshman year, came back to midfield his sophomore year, and was still producing at an incredibly high level. I think that's just it fits Virginia's, like, they get what they need out of the portal mode. You know, if you imagine him on this team last year, and obviously he's not going to be on the team that we had last year, he's going to be on next year's team, but he would have been, you know, one of the missing pieces that Virginia needed to, you know, maybe have a more serious championship weekend than they ended up having. I think he's going to be the highest impact player. I just like Virginia's history with transfers, and I like the talent that he brings. I think that, you know, he had a lot of other options as well in the transfer portal. I know a lot of other teams are going after him. He's going to be, you know, I don't know, how many points is he going to get? I'm not sure. He's going to get 50 points as a midfielder. I think that's a reasonable expectation for him at Virginia.
Okay. I like the pick for you. I like the pick for me too. I had him 7th on my big board. So, value there for your boy.
The fact that you have a big board makes me think that you're going to dominate me in this conversation here.
Well, a big board is just going through the list of guys who we know where they're going and then putting them in the order of the impact that I think they're going to make. And I am going to belie my my past, as well as a little bit of the evidence that we've seen, predominantly informed by the season that Chase Erland had for Hopkins this year. And you know, even though the Blue Jays made it to the quarterfinals last year, made it to the quarterfinals again this year, so, you know, nominally they made it just as far, I do think that the role that goalie play had in getting to that destination was different last year or this year. And so I'm going to go with Mike G., Michael Gianfracaro from Princeton heading to North Carolina as the most impactful player for me. And then I'm going to stick with the goalie pick and go with Luke Stout to Johns Hopkins as the 3rd overall pick, my 2nd pick in terms of the next most impactful player.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I can't, you know, if we were actually assembling a real team and you picked 2 goalies back to back, I would question your question your judgment, but I can see
that's
it.
A good call.
You know, Mike G, you know, his, like, he was so impressive at Princeton, and like how his steadiness, I guess, would be the word. You know, I know he had some games that were this year that weren't his best, but just his poise was really impressive. I got 2 different guys that, so we're doing snake draft style, right? So I get 2.
That's correct.
All right. I'm gonna go with Mike Race, Syracuse, from RIT to Syracuse, LSM. Can play close. He started his career with a short stick. You know, he's like one of those guys who absolutely does everything. I am hedging a little bit in the sense that, you know, he was, you know, has been severely injured, you know, this year with RIT. If anyone watched that national championship game, he was basically held together with scotch tape, you know, a partially torn PCL. So that's obviously something very significant that he's going to have to deal with, and I'm not sure what his timetable is for recovery for that. But heart and soul guy, international experience, has played at the highest level, played in championship moments, you know, not only at RIT, but, you know, with Team Canada and, you know, elsewhere in his career. So just a guy that I think can do it all and seems like a Syracuse guy. And that's something they need, right? They need guys who have played for championships. And we saw the value of, like, those transfers who came in last year to guide the young team to where they got. You know, I still think they need that veteran influx at Syracuse. And then I'm going to go with Eric Molliver going to Duke. You know, that's my big question mark, I guess, about him is, you know, he's kind of been suspecting this transfer a little bit throughout the season at Maryland. You know, there was kind of whispers that might happen. I'm curious, like, if he has more of a chance to be the guy at Duke, how much he can truly be unleashed in that offense. So I'm going to go with him as my next impact guy.
So one of the things that's a little bit of a through line and kind of a binary in terms of how much value is being derived from these players are, do they only have 1 year of eligibility left or do they have multiple years? And with Hackett, obviously has multiple years. I'm assuming Mike Grace has multiple years as well because of the 21 every, you know, blanket waiver D3. Do you know, or do you have a hunch?
I do not know.
Okay.
you know, I think that there's a cap on that at some point, right? Because the D3 guys just basically
they get to play college across forever.
Yeah, they just haven't. There is no eligibility rules, it seems like, after COVID. I'm not sure.
But yeah, and then similarly, like, I assume that Malvern only has 1 year as well. But given his injury, I don't know that to be the case. It's a good pick. It's a good pick. I think there is going to be so much change at Duke in terms of their offense, that not just role, but also, and then the other thing with Malvern too is that the ACL is a 2-year injury, right? And so, you know, I think there's presumption that he's not going to get back to the level of athleticism that he had coming out of high school. I don't know that that's fair, right? We've seen, you know, guys in year two coming away from ACLs that do get back. All right, I'm kind of torn now between that question of 1 year of eligibility versus multiple years of eligibility, but I think, I'm going to stick with my board. I'm going to go with Pace Billings, the LSM from Princeton going to Michigan. Yeah, I think Bo Patterson is a good example of the impact that an incredibly high-level player from the Rocky Mountain region can have in Ann Arbor. I think he was arguably the best joystick D midi in the country this year. I don't know that that's necessarily the level that Pace is going to reach, being the best LSM in the country for the Wolverines, but that's why I'm so high on him. And then I'm going to go with Patrick Hackler, the Yale midfielder going to Johns Hopkins. I started to work on, you know, kind of the personnel returners and losses for 25 next year. And just to give, you know, another peek behind the curtain in terms of how this works, it's basically just a spreadsheet that kind of, you know, puts everybody into their respective columns. And, you know, this was the exercise that I did that led me to really question whether Syracuse had enough homegrown senior leadership last year. You know, this year, one of my biggest takeaways, and I'm not all the way through it, is the Johns Hopkins shortstick D midfield unit is decimated. I mean, they don't have a guy coming back that has experience doing it. So, you know, Hackler is an exceptional player and really a true two-way midfielder in terms of his ability to, you know, take the wings of faceoffs and play offense as well. But the role that the Blue Jays are going to need more than offense is in that defense and two-way guy. And I think that, you know, he was the best available player on the board. They got him. They won a head-to-head battle with Notre Dame for him. I asked him why, and he said the opportunity to play with Jack Monfort was a big factor in the consideration. We've seen that from Yale guys in the past. So, whether it was the guys that went to Denver or the guys that went to Notre Dame. So from that standpoint, not a shock, but at the same time, a meaningful one relative to the Blue Jays and raising their ceiling.
Okay. You got another one, right?
No, I took Billings first and Hackler.
Oh, yeah. Talked about Hackler a lot more than Billings, but So
sorry, Pace. Sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Billings.
Well, I mean, I think that you can basically just go down the line of Princeton guys, and you're pretty well off if you just do that. But I'm gonna go. I don't necessarily think that these are my like next two high impact guys, but they are. I'm pairing them together just because of, you know, how I'll explain here, but Jack Dowd and Noah Armitage at Maryland. Dowd coming from Salisbury, Armitage coming from Stony Brook. Basically, like, if you can add, a midfielder who's like 6'4" and a midfielder who's like 6'5", and both talented and can score goals, that's huge. And, you know, knowing Dowd a little bit more, obviously Armitage had a pretty awesome year, but Dowd like just feels like a Maryland lacrosse player. I don't know if that, like, I think Maryland people will know what I mean when I say that, but I don't really have a good explanation for what it means. That as, like, two guys who instantly make your offense just more physical and better overall. I'm packaging them together as my next two picks.
I am going to stick with the Maryland theme with my next pick, and I'm going to go with AJ Hernandez, the defenseman from Navy. Again, this is a little bit of a blurred line between an on versus off the record conversation, but when he was still in the portal before he had decided where to go, I was watching the National High School Showcase, I think is what it was called, the Victory Event Series event at Loyola, and I was watching, I believe it was Bullis versus Culver with actually Torpy and Amplo, and AJ Hernandez has been one of my favorite players since 2017, something along those lines. Seeing him with, I believe it was the first Nation United team, and he was playing up at the time. And this is a little bit of a weird comparison because they're not that similar athletically, but I would also group Brett Koopman into this because, you know, it was a similar type of exposure. And they, and the reason I gravitated their game so much was also similar, which is that they're just playmakers defensively, right? In terms of their ability to knock down passes, ground balls, be useful in the clearing game, you know, their ability to stay in front of guys and whatever. It's just, it's not what I care as much about relative to, you know, hedging and supporting off ball, making good slide decisions, being in the right position, and then all those possession killing plays that I just mentioned. So anyhow, back to the conversation that I was having, you know, I assumed that I was higher on Hernandez's ceiling than Amplo was just because I was so high on him. That is not the case. I'm not going to say what he said because, again, it might have been off the record. But I left that conversation with such high hopes and expectations for, you know, what Hernandez might be if he gets onto the field. And there were some questions coming away from his departure from the academy academically. And I, you know, I believe he might not even have actually been on the roster this year. And so that was percolating into where he was going to be able to get in and where it was going to be the right fit academically and progress toward a degree and everything else that goes along with that. So the fact that he's going to, you know, be a Terp and have the opportunity to compete at the highest level is just really, really exciting. So AJ Hernandez is my next pick, and then I'm gonna stick with the long pole kind of situation, and I'm gonna go with Greg Campisi, the Harvard long.
I was lining that one up.
Those are the reactions. That's why draft format is so much better than any other type of format for doing these things, because that's exactly what you want to hear. But yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think that the perception was that he didn't have the same level of season this year that maybe he did last year in 23. But at the same time, and not only that, but I also think maybe he flew a little bit under the radar because he committed before the season. You know, so it wasn't as if his news just came out. But yeah, I love his game, and I think he's going to be a great fit, and he's going to fill a need for Notre Dame. You know, they bring back one of the best long sticks in Will Donovan, right? Mm-hmm. But they do graduate some guys down close, and then some depth in Ross Bergmaster. So there are three poles that played a ton that are departing, and what role Campisi fills, what role Donovan fills, that's going to be a little bit of a question mark for me. But either way, I think it's fair to anticipate they're both going to get on the field and make substantial impacts.
Yeah, and if you give Coach Corrigan and Coach Wellner a guy who's talented with a long pole, they will find the best use out of them. That does not concern me if someone is playing his position.
It's back to you.
I went with the Maryland duo because I thought it was just cute to have two guys together or whatever. That's Campisi was definitely next to my list. I could just stick with Maryland this whole time because I think that what they brought in is excellent. So that's one of my considerations here. What do you want? I'm going to go with Ryan Donnery, going to Ohio State from Quinnipiac. Played, known most as a midfielder, but, you know, played some attack as well. Ohio State, just like, you know, obviously they did not have a good season last year, but, you know, in terms of like their ability to acclimate transfers, I think it's pretty clear that they have, they figured it out. They know how to bring transfers into the roster. So I'm going to go with them, and I'm going
to
keep.
Move on to your next pick. I ran into Nick Myers yesterday, and we caught up for a while, and he is super excited about Donnery and then the transfer class in total, specifically relative to a combination of their left-handedness and how much that was a need for the Buckeyes, as well as just their overall level of production. And I think that, you know, the conversation that has been had, you know, on social media and elsewhere has been about you know, can these guys play at this level? And, you know, whether it was the D3 guys that made the transition to D1 or, you know, the guys that leveled up in conference, it's not a 100% hit rate, of course. But at the same time, right, like, you know, King Kong going from Villanova to Maryland, the Big East is not the Big Ten athletically. And he was arguably, you know, just as instrumental in winning a national championship as pretty much everybody not named Logan Wisnauskas or Luke Weirman or maybe Logan McNaney on the roster. And so, you know, I am not nearly as concerned about that leveling up in competition as, you know, maybe the consensus is. And then the only other thing that I would add is, you know, for me, Ryan Donnery was... When it came to All-America voting, one of my biggest picadillos is voting for attackmen at midfield because mm-hmm. they're listed as midfielder on their rosters. And now it's hard. Ultimately, if you don't watch every game, and not only that, but also like how, you have to define how what a midfielder actually is, right? You know. But that being said, Ryan Donnery was legitimately a midfielder. So I had him in my honorable mention midfield consideration and actually voted for him as an honorable mention All-American in 2024. And I think he's going to be a great addition for the Buckeyes, and I think that was a great pick by you.
There's a few midfielders I'm considering here, you know, just because there's so many good ones, and I think that, like, you know, in terms of, like, transfer impact, like, you can't have enough good midfielders. But I think I'm going to go with fills an area of need very well, and that's Tyler Sandoval going to Villanova, the face-off specialist. Basically, you know, Justin Coppola was fantastic. He was a fifth-year guy for Villanova, and I think you've seen, like, how good that team can be when they have someone at the faceoff X, you know, who is proficient and you know, the way that their offense works. I think he's going to make the biggest, he might not be like the most well-known in terms of like when he goes to his new, you know, when he goes to Villanova and what he accomplishes there. But the fact that like, he's going to give them a sufficient guy at the faceoff X with a offense that grew up a lot this year. I think he's going to have a tremendous impact on that team in, you know, kind of leveling up that position for them.
All right. So you've made seven picks. I've made six. So I'm going to make my seventh and eighth right here. And then we're going to go back to you. My big board is still mostly intact. So I am going to take Paul Weddington, a short 60 midi from Princeton heading to Duke. He missed the majority of this season due to injury. And, you know, again, the Blue Devils graduate a lot. They are not nearly as bare in the short 60 midi position as Hopkins is, for example. And so, you know, I might have had Weddington a little bit higher up the board had it not been for some of the lingering questions around injury recovery. But, you know, at the very least, in Jack Gray in Aiden McGuire. Yeah, and Jack Gray. There's some weapons, there's some bullets in the chamber, so to speak, at the short 60 minute position for the Blue Devils. But in Charlie O'Connor and Jake Caputo, they did graduate some, and so I think he'll be in a position to provide some pop. And then I'm gonna take Charles Balsamo next. Yeah, I don't know whether he's gonna play attack or midfield, but the lefty, I can see it. That was another one that you wanted. I think he's in a position to really flourish. And I don't know exactly what his role is going to look like for the Cavaliers, but he's got 2 years of eligibility left. So, you know, that kind of additional one. I've been more grad heavy than you have. Not so much, but a little bit so. And so I'm gonna hedge that over maybe a couple of the other grad students that I would have looked at for my, what is that, my eighth pick.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going totally with Balsamo, and just kind of what the point I made before about I just trust Virginia's diligence in the portal, and I think he's a guy that changes scenery and will just do him well no matter what, you know, part of the field he ends up on. I just trust that staff's ability to, you know, they did their homework, they have an idea where he's going to be, and, you know, their ability to interchange pieces has been proven, you know, pretty great over the past, you know, handful of years in this transfer portal era. So that's a great pick that I was going to do as well. I'm going to go with I haven't picked a short stick D-midi, so I'm going to do that right now. And I'm going to go with Jack Erb, from Siena to Georgetown. He's a guy that I just don't think people realize his impact at Siena. I really trust the coaching staff there at Siena as well. And I think that, you know, Georgetown, you know, just, again, is in that boat of, like, he's a guy that was coached, you know, well by Liam Gleason, a guy who knows defense. He's going to go to a place that knows defense as well under Kevin Warren, and going to play a significant role there. Obviously, short stick D-minis don't get the attention, so, like, you might not hear his name week in and week out, but that's because he's doing his job and he's going to do it effectively the whole time. So I'm going to go with him, and then, let's look on my board, so to speak, here. I'm going to take out the transfers to D2 and D3 for a moment here, although that's one that I wanted to kind of put in there. But I am going to stick in a D3 to D1 guy, and that's Dan Donahue, the goalie at Union College going to Providence. Again, I value, you know, he's just put in a million minutes over his career, and I value guys who have played in big-time games and big-time moments. He played in the national championship game. Union was a team that, you know, competing for Liberty League championships and playing at the highest level, and I don't have a goalie. He's going to be my goalie pick.
Excellent. So I think you've got one left, but we're going to recap this here momentarily. I am going to go with Chris Patterson, the attackman from Hobart heading to Penn. He's got 3 years of eligibility left. He he's a Dodger slasher. He was really effective for the Statesman this year, and he was really highly sought after. And I think that, you know, once a couple of the decisions like Balsamo going to Virginia and Molliver going to Duke were made, that kind of made Patterson's choice a little bit clearer. And then let's see. So that's my ninth pick. With my 10th, oh man, this is tough. I am going to go with Vinny Trujillo, the short stick D-midi from Syracuse heading to Loyola. It's a speculative pick. Again, taking an underclassman with multiple years of eligibility left. You know, the depth or the size of the stable that Syracuse ran their short stick D-midis this year, you know, it was kind of like if you have two quarterbacks, you don't have one. If you have 10 D middies, does it mean you don't have four? Because that's what it felt like at times. And so I don't know what that means. But at the same time, I do know that, you know, whether it was a guy like Mustang Sally or you know, Loyola has had some of the best short stick D middies in the entire sport for 10 years, 15 years, really, if you go back to that 2012 national championship game. So I don't know if it's a function of their development or if it's a function of their recruitment, but I'm going to bet on the infrastructure here and say that Trujillo meets some of the expectations that were set for him in the recruiting circuit and maybe didn't necessarily come to fruition in the Carrier Dome.
All right, so I got one more. Tough, but I'm actually surprised he's still on the board here. I'm going to go with Jack Amon, going from Rutgers to Penn State. You know, just familiarity with the Big Ten. And, you know, I think that, and I had this conversation with the Maryland staff at a summer event. Like, Big Ten, and I think the reason that Maryland made this, like, surprise, so to speak, run in the NCAA tournament, I think part of it was just getting out of the Big Ten and just, like, the grind that is. And just someone who's, like, familiar with going from Big Ten to another Big Ten team, someone who's familiar with that is going to make that transition much easier. It's just a different style of play. It's grind is, you know, the exact right word there. You know, he's a 20 goal scorers, you know, a bunch of big games for Rutgers. And I think he's just going to make that transition pretty seamlessly over to Penn State.
All right, so let's recap. You took Johnny Hackett, Mike Grace, Eric Molliver, Jack Dowd, Noah Armitage, Ryan Donnery, Tyler Sandoval, Jack Erb, Dan Donahue, and Jack Amon. As expected, with three of your 10 picks not coming from not Division I, I'm sure that you did a better job kind of assessing or analyzing it at that level than I did. I took Mike Gianfragaro, Luke Stout, Pace Billings, Patrick Hackler, AJ Hernandez, Greg Campisi, Paul Wethington, Charles Balsamo, Chris Patterson, and Vinny Trujillo. We're going to post these on social media. We want you to vote for which team, who won the draft. Matt, how do you feel about your team in totality?
I feel like you did a better job at the when you said some of the names on the list, I'm like, oh man. So whatever.
A few shout outs. I'll just kind of read through the rest of my board. Guys that I'm not surprised that they're still here, but whatever. Like other guys that I would have taken if we had gone deeper. Bryce Ford, the attackman from Fairfield, heading to Maryland. Aiden Blake, the middie from Cornell, heading to Duke. Part of the reason that he wasn't higher up the board for me was just, again, going back to role. Don't know what he's going to be asked to do. Jack Monfort, the middie from Yale, going to Hopkins. We talked about him already. DJ Dixon, middie from Wesleyan, a homegrown Michigan guy heading back to play for the Wolverines. Nick Dupuy, the feeder from Stony Brook, an attackman heading to North Carolina. Fulton Bayman, the attackman from Notre Dame, who was kind of their emo specialist slash fourth attackman, heading to Georgetown. Probably would have been in the mix to start had he stayed in South Bend. Spencer Wertheim, kind of borderline second line middie at Cornell, national championship game participant 2 years ago, heading to Carolina. Andrew O'Berry, a middie from Harvard, heading to North Carolina. And Jeb Brenfleck, the attackman from Penn State, heading to High Point, who I feel like is going to help establish, you know, that high-end culture, that Big Ten culture that you just talked about alongside John Crowley. Any other guys that you want to shout out?
Yeah. The pride of Archbishop Curley High School, Dom Zingo, going to Jacksonville, from Lynchburg. And not many times you get a Curley guy in D1. Might be the first to my knowledge. So, obviously Kyle Hartzell was a Curley guy, did not play D1 lacrosse, but, you know, was an all-world member. So shout out to him. And Jacksonville is just a team that Lynchburg to Jacksonville pipeline is very strong. So he's a good one. Ethan Barnard, Rutgers faceoff guy, is another one. And then talking about guys who are going to D2, the people's goalie going to Tampa, Connor Ferriero. That's a guy who, you know, Tampa's going to be a team that's going to compete for the national championship. And he's a guy that, you know, when you talk about impact, you know, whatever number of extra saves he gives them per game could be the difference between winning a national championship and not winning a national championship. So that will have a huge impact for Tampa.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. As we've talked about, there are a ton of really good players who have already decided where they're headed. And there are a lot of players that are still in the portal, undecided, trying to figure out where they're going to go. I think that with respect to the 3-day lag between when we're recording and when this posts, these are the likeliest to change insofar as maybe some of these destinations kind of having been decided. But Matt, we're each going to pick three. Once again, we will do it snake draft style. You went number one last time. Does that mean I get to go first this time?
Yeah, and then I'll pick two, right?
All
right,
perfect. You'll pick two and three.
Right. All right, I'll pick two people.
Correct. Well said. I am torn between two guys, and I don't expect either of them to be available at number four. So this is a really difficult and important pick for me. I'm torn between so one guy I think is better and one or two people who are very close to him think is better, and then the other guy I think like is more conventional wisdom, better, a little bit more sought after, and I'm just trying to decide whether to trust my gut or go with the other guy. And I'm not going to tell you which is which, by the way. I'm going to go with Griffin Turner, the middie from Hofstra.
Okay. Now, you did not mention a guy, and face-off Andrew Greenspan, Notre Dame face-off specialist.
We should mention, we are excluding him from the list because there's, you know, a lot of reporting around his entering the portal, includes the prospect or possibility of him going back. And if memory serves, he's also a no-contact guy. So not necessarily the same type of pursuit or recruitment for him as a lot of the other guys that we're talking about here.
Gotcha. So I'm going to go – I feel like my Maryland alum bias is kind of showing here, but – you know, Owen Murphy, I think, is just obviously the most talented player that's in the portal.
He was the other one that I was between Murphy and Turner. And again, I'm not gonna confirm which was the described which way.
So another guy who is, I would describe, like a lot of my picks is like, I think he's going to make an impact, but I'm not sure how much he's on the radar for people. And that's going to be Mitch Dunham from Mount St. Mary's, former MAC Defensive Player of the Year. You know, just a steady guy who is going to fit into a top three, you know, for most teams in the country. I'm not sure if he's going to be the, you know, the number one guy at most teams where he ends up, but he will certainly be a guy that, like, you're going to rely on him game in and game out on your roster.
I am going to go with Tommy Barnes, the midfielder from Princeton. He was, you know, kind of a borderline first second line guy, extra man guy, really good shooter, really good decision maker. You know, I think he's kind of in between whether or not he's going to choose to play, but for the time being, he is still in the portal. And then I am going to go with Colton Marquis, the attackman from Johns Hopkins, who's the lone Blue Jay that entered the portal. Don't have an indication where he's going to end up, but just a really, really talented box player who is tearing it up in Canada so far this summer.
Okay, I get that. I'm going to go with Dutch Furlong, Bucknell. You know, he's got a bunch of assists. You know, I think his 2023 season, I think he had, you know, somewhere around 40 assists. You know, going to be, I think Bucknell, like guys who play in the Patriot League, and, you know, he's just got the pedigree. He went to Gilman. You know, he's 6'1", 6'2", something like that. Bucknell, I think he, you know, you kind of got to be a smart player, you know, to be at Bucknell. So I think he's going to seamlessly fit wherever he goes. And, you know, that feeder role is something that, like, you know, can make – he might be a guy that, like, he just elevates everyone else around him more than he sticks out himself, but is certainly going to make an impact wherever he lands.
Matt, we have gone literally double the time that I wanted to go with this podcast. But it was, again, I think pretty good, pretty dense.
You preface this with, I want to keep this to a half an hour, and we're an hour and 15 minutes in or something like that.
Yep. So apologies to the listeners for making your ears bleed once again. But thank you to you, Coach Kinnear, for all of your insight. And once again, it's been great to talk, man. We talk most days or most of the day every day, but we usually haven't pressed record. So it was fun to get back on the old Riverside and get it done.
Yeah, I think we just need to find a way to, like, open up our Slack to the public, or at least, like, a segment of our Slack. That maybe that's the IL premium that we can come up with, and just get these off-the-cuff conversations all the time, as opposed to in the more formal sit-down format.
All right, well, that'll do it for this edition of the Source Podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review, tell a friend, and we'll be back, like I said, in 2 days with another IL Preps podcast. It's summertime, but that doesn't mean lacrosse has stopped. So keep checking out InsideLacrosse.com, and we will keep giving you a reason to check it out.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.